all those who are expecting me to speak about the fractional quantum Hall effect, please leave now. It's what I had originally thought I would talk about. But I find it very, very hard to talk about anything except what I'm interested in at the moment, and it's not the quantum Hall effect. What am I interested in? I think it's a combination of things which could be called the defeats that string theory has suffered, which are very serious in my opinion. The first of them is, of course, that it has failed to give a unique and precise particle physics spectrum that somewhere in the string theory space of configurations there might be something that looks like a particle physics spectrum. Maybe so. But there are many, many other things which don't look anything like it. So there's a richness and embarrassment of riches. The string theory is too easy in a sense. It's too easy to find vacuums since there's only one nature. Something about the theory had better be very, very hard. What I think is probably very hard is cosmology. So if it's cosmology that leads us to the right description of nature, namely cosmology tells us what vacuum to pick, then it ought to be very hard to find cosmologies, and I can assure you that it is very hard to find cosmologies in string theory or any other theory that are quantum consistent. So those two things may in fact go together. Our failure to find unique descriptions of particle physics, and I would say our rather complete failure, in my opinion, this is a matter of opinion, matter of taste, good taste and bad taste, I would say that we have not succeeded in cracking even a little opening at all into the door of cosmology in string theory. That's my opinion. And another fundamental problem, which I have sort of ignored for the last 10 years or so, in fact, I've sort of refused to think about for the last 10 years or so, is what goes on in the interior of black holes. What goes on behind the horizons of black holes? Is that a worthwhile thing to study? String theory by now has purportedly given us a complete theory of black holes, but that complete theory of black holes is a theory of black holes as they would be seen by somebody outside black holes. In other words, it's a quantum mechanics of an S matrix of black holes, formation and evaporation of black holes, but never do we address the question in string theory or in any of the more recent developments based on the holographic principle, based on the IRUV connection, based on the counting of string black hole, the counting of microstates of black holes. Never do we address the question of what goes on behind the horizon of a black hole. I'm going to talk about two of those things today. I'm not going to talk about the detailed particle spectrum. Obviously, I have nothing whatever to say about it, except that perhaps it's determined by cosmology. But I want to talk about the two failures, the failure of cosmology and the failure of understanding the interior of black holes. Now, the question in my mind is, one of the questions is whether this is a technical failure, an inability to do a technically hard problem, or whether we are really lacking very, very fundamental new concepts. My own opinion is the latter, that we are missing extremely fundamental concepts at such a deep level that we should probably question everything. And if I have any message at all today, it's to question everything that that anybody ever tells you about quantum cosmology. But in particular, I want to talk about cosmology, and I want to talk about the interior of black holes. I've drawn here for you just in order to make it clear that these two questions are connected with each other, and really they're just one question. I've drawn three distinct geometries, each of which has a Penrose diagram, which is exactly the same as every other one. this is the Penrose diagram for the sitter space. It's a square, that's all it is. This happens to be the Penrose diagram for radiation-dominated Friedman-Robertson-Walker geometry. It looks exactly the same. In fact, I'm not going to talk about this. I just wanted to point out that this is a third case of a Penrose diagram which looks exactly the same. And this Penrose diagram is the Penrose diagram for an anti-de Sitter space, Schwarzschild black hole. What I'm really interested in is the similarity between this and this. They are identical. The geometries are not identical. They're far from identical to each other metrically. Metrically, they're quite different. For example, this line here in de Sitter space is simply the pole of a certain sphere, north pole or south pole of a certain sphere, whereas here, this line here marks the boundary, the causal boundary at infinity, the causal time-like boundary at infinity of anti-de Sitter space. This line here, sorry, anti-de Sitter space. Yes, if I, you've got to watch me because I'm sometimes going to say anti-de Sitter when I mean de Sitter. So, and vice versa. Well, we'll talk about these. We'll talk about these two geometries further in a little while. But let me point out to you one feature that all these geometries have in common. They all have, in a sense, an end of time. Now, of course, in a certain sense, and de Sitter space, excuse me, de Sitter space in a certain sense, and also, incidentally, ADS, Schwarzschild black hole, does not really have an end to time, but it does have an end to time when drawn as a Penrose diagram. And the meaning of that is that there are future horizons, and in particular, what it means is points fall, points at fixed location, fixed coordinate location, as time goes on, fall out of causal contact with each other so that they can never communicate with each other. This point over here and this point over here earlier on could have sent messages to each other, but as time goes on, they simply fall out of causal contact with each other, and so they can never communicate with each other. That means that certain kinds of experiments that we might think ought to make sense in a quantum field theory describing what's going on in these spaces here, don't make any physical sense. For example, the question of what the correlation is between quantum fields at this location may make some mathematical sense in quantum field theory in a fixed background, but it makes no physical sense in the sense that nobody can ever measure it because nobody can ever send a signal from one point to the other to report the measurements that they've made. I think under these circumstances that quantum mechanics described on global sections of these spaces probably doesn't mean anything. Repeated experiments can't be done. Correlation functions cannot be measured by anybody, and I think we should even begin to question such things as quantum mechanics itself in such contexts. Now, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to question quantum mechanics, but I want to point out to you that these geometries do have the feature that if we were to think of propagating quantum fields in these backgrounds, after a point it would become rather meaningless to compute correlations that nobody could ever measure. What I'm going to talk about is quantum gravity in de Sitter space, and one particular aspect of it. I don't have a lot to say about it. I just have actually just one thing to say about it, and it's a small thing, but I happen to think it's an extremely important thing. It was described in a paper by myself, Lisa Dyson from MIT, and James Lindesay. This is not Harvard University, that's Howard University. And it concerns, to a certain extent, ideas which have been expressed in the literature as the DS-CFT connection and the existence of an S matrix in de Sitter space. That's the question, that's the set of questions I want to address. So let me begin, before talking about de Sitter space, let me remind you about some facts about quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space, and now I mean the version of quantum gravity which argues that it's equivalent to a quantum field theory on the boundary. So here is the Penrose diagram for anti-de Sitter space. Anti-de Sitter space is basically a hollow cavity. R equals 0 is the center of that cavity. R equals infinity. It doesn't look like it's at infinity, but it happens to be an infinite proper distance away. However, the geometry is such that a light ray can propagate to infinity and back in a finite time. And the result of that is, for most practical purposes, the anti-de Sitter space should be thought of as a finite cavity with boundaries finitely far away in the causal sense, that light takes a finite time to get there and back. Now, we would like to do string theory. Everybody would like to do string theory in anti-de Sitter space. And we think we know how to do that now. We think that the objects of the theory, the objects that make sense, are certain boundary correlators. Boundary correlators either of string vertices, string vertices evaluated at the boundary, or in various limits, just field theoretic correlators. When I speak about field theory right now, I'm speaking about bulk field theory, and I mean graviton correlators and things like that, graviton or dilaton correlators. Graviton or dilaton correlators can also be evaluated at the boundary. The physics itself is bulk physics, but we can evaluate these things on the boundary. And those are the objects of the ADS-CFT correspondence, and it's widely believed that they are exactly equivalent to a set of corresponding correlators in a quantum field theory. In fact, I think most of us believe, I don't know what most of you believe, I know what most of me believes, that there is an exact correspondence between gravity, quantum gravity even, in the bulk of anti-de Sitter space, and a corresponding boundary field theory, boundary conformal field theory at the boundary. And what exact sense it lives at the boundary is not important for me right now. There's a little asterisk here. Boundary limits mean something particular. Typically, the correlators die off like some power of something as you go closer to the boundary. They actually do go to zero at the boundary, but they go to zero as some power of a coordinate that I'll call y, which is some distance from the boundary, not proper distance from the boundary, but coordinate distance from the boundary. And they go to zero like y to a power, where the power depends on the dimensionality of the CFT field that corresponds to the object. So I just wanted to remind you that typically you have to strip off these factors before you have well-defined correlators. Now, this connection between anti-de Sitter space and conformal field theory could have been guessed or not guessed or derived, quote derived, by derived I don't mean mathematically derived, but conceptually derived, from a combination of two things: the holographic principle, which says that the degrees of freedom of a system are in one-to-one correspondence with the Planckian cells on the boundary of a system, together with the statement that the action of the anti-de Sitter symmetry group acting on the boundary is the conformal group. One might have guessed, if I was smarter, I would have guessed that the holographic description in anti-de Sitter space should be that of a conformal field theory. So I'm not quite finished with anti-de Sitter space. Let me just mention one other important connection. The degrees of freedom in the boundary theory, which describe bulk information, now this is a very, very cloudy and confused subject, but what is clear is that the degrees of freedom, I use the word Wilson loops here, anything in a gauge theory can be written in terms of Wilson loops, nothing particularly important about that. What is important is that the deeper you are away from the boundary of the anti-de Sitter space, the corresponding piece of information that corresponds to whatever it happens to be, a field or an object, those objects, when represented in the gauge theory, in the CFT, become more and more non-local as you move more and more into the bulk. Or, said the other way, as a piece of information of some kind, could be any number of different kinds of objects, move closer and closer to the boundary, they define objects in the quantum field theory which have a smaller and smaller region of support. And typically, therefore, the limits of the bulk objects themselves correspond to non-local blobs, but as you move them closer and closer to the boundary, those non-local blobs get smaller and smaller regions of support, and the result is they define local fields. The local fields that they define, usually, again, you have to strip off certain power law factors associated with the dimensionality of the objects. And so we understand now, to some degree, to a limited, very limited degree, the connection between bulk position and size of configuration in the boundary description. All right, so that's the ADS-CFT correspondence. Now, one feature of this ADS-CFT correspondence has to do with black holes. In particular, the particular black hole that I drew on the blackboard before, which is the ADS-CFT Schwarzschild black hole, this is a black hole whose radius is bigger than or equal to the radius of curvature of the ADS space. So it's a large black hole. It's completely stable. It does not evaporate and can be thought of as a black hole in a box which has stabilized it, the box being the anti-de Sitter space itself. Here again is the Penrose diagram for it. If this were an ordinary Schwarzschild black hole, instead of these boundaries over here, which are time-like, and we can say reflecting, we would have scry pluses and scry minuses. I really hate the word scry. I really wish nobody ever invented it. It's probably the worst word in physics. And besides, I don't know how to make a scry on my computer, so. So ADS is much better. It doesn't have scries. It has vertical boundaries here. But otherwise it's pretty much a black hole. All right? And again, it looks like a cosmology. The singularity could be thought of as being pretty much like a Big Bang. The singularity at the other end could be thought of as a big crunch. We can imagine people living in here, lasting long, long periods of time if the radius of curvature is big enough. But we've never learned successfully how to think about what's going on behind the horizon. This region here is the region which is not behind the horizon, and it's the region which we believe is described well, and in some sense exactly, by the ADS-CFT correspondence, the CFT, the conformal field theory, which lives on the boundary. Okay, so we think we understand, if we were observers, incidentally, this is t equals minus infinity, this is t equals and plus infinity, these lines here are lines of fixed ordinary time, these lines here are lines of fixed ordinary position, and notice, although it won't play any great role, that the boundary has been doubled for these eternal black holes. It has two boundaries instead of one boundary, but otherwise it's just ADS-CFT usual thing. Now, there's a concept that's occurred that we've developed in the theory of black holes, and in particular in the quantum theory of black holes, that I've always called black hole complementarity. Maybe I should call it horizon complementarity. And it's basically the idea that no information is ever lost behind the horizon of a black hole. How to reconcile that with the picture here, I'm not going to discuss today, but we do believe, and certainly the ADS-CFT makes it completely clear, that no information can ever be lost to the observer at the boundary here, because the observer at the boundary simply, this describes all of physics by a completely unitary quantum field theory, and information can never be lost out of that quantum field theory. So this ADS-CFT is a very complete version of black hole complementarity that teaches us for sure that despite the look of these diagrams, and it looks as if things can fall behind the horizon and be completely lost, no information loss ever goes on as far as the external observer is concerned. The boundary evolution is completely unitary. Now, physical quantities, for example, are sensitive to this question of whether information is lost or is not lost behind the boundary of an eternal black hole like this. Well, I used to think that only the most complicated things you could imagine could possibly remember the fact that information was not lost behind the horizon. But Maldacena gave a simple example, and I want to go through that simple example, tell you what Maldacena said, and later on we'll come back to it and prove that what he said is correct. Think of the correlators. Now, keep in mind, this is the boundary here, and we're talking about boundary correlators. Correlators, these could be correlators of gauge invariant objects in the conformal field theory, or equivalently, bulk fields describing gravitons, dilatons, and so forth, the correlators between time T1 and T2. Okay? You can make that calculation, just correlators, let's say H mu nu at this point and H mu nu at that point. You can calculate these correlators simply by solving the wave equation, the standard wave equation, in the fixed background of the ADS black hole. That is not hard for some people to do, it's hard for me to do, but it's not hard for me to figure out roughly what the answer is. And the answer, I've forgotten the detailed coefficient that appears here, it's in Maldacena's paper. The answer is that if you calculate the correlator between T1 and T2, in the limit that T1 and T2 separate to very large time separations, we can think of it as one of them going off to the early times, the other one going off to the late times, that correlator is exponentially suppressed, exponentially small with time. I'll come back to it, I think, later, but let me tell you that when correlators fall off exponentially like this, this typically means that there's some dissipation going on. When do correlators fall off exponentially? When you have dissipation in a thermal cavity with friction and everything else, you disturb the system. The effect of that disturbance disappears exponentially with time. That is usually just dissipation. And I'm going to argue in a moment that that is really just a thermal dissipation effect. But this is what the nominal calculation by calculating the Green's function in this geometry would give. However, Maldacena said, no, this should not be right. There should be some long-time memory simply because information can never be lost through the horizon. And this would certainly look like lost information. You perturb the system, and then you wait a long time, and you see what the system is doing, and you find out that there's a vanishingly small response. Maldacena says, no, that should not be the case, that the correct answer should be exponentially small, but should remember, exponentially small, but not exponentially small in time, just exponentially small in the entropy, meaning to say no matter how long you wait, the effect of a little disturbance will never completely disappear, and that little bit of information that you perturb the system over here will be remembered at late times. But with what magnitude? The answer is that the magnitude, according to Maldacena, is roughly of order of magnitude e to the minus the entropy of the system. So while the correlator does get small, according to Maldacena, it never gets smaller than an amount which is of order e to the minus s. Yeah?
How does it go if there's no black hole?
Then it oscillates. Then it's just ADS periodic.
The limit works on zero.
Say it again.
The limit where you take the entropy of the black hole to zero gives you exactly.
Well, then it sort of goes to one, and one is just a periodic. Okay, so this is interesting. This is
from another
standpoint. Well, we can certainly no derivation of this in Maldacena's paper. I'm going to give you a derivation of it. He argued maybe it comes from another saddle point. And I'm gonna leave that open. That's an open question, I think, whether it... I think that part of the paper is so cloudy that I really can't tell. And I think he also would say it's very cloudy.
It was just periodically identified ABS, right, was the other saddle point that he was adding.
But it gave an answer like this.
Well, it gives... We're going to come back to it. I honestly don't know if that's the point or not. But the question is...
Isn't that the point where...
Well... Perhaps. But the point is, was certainly not that he first derived this by summing over topologies and then said, oh, this is interesting. The logic was the other way. The logic was, being an expert at statistical mechanics and thermodynamics and so forth, he realized that this is a very, very general kind of answer and said, where might it come from? And then he speculated that it might come from some over topology, and it might. I have no quibble with that. I just, it's, for the moment, it's not my, I'll come back to that. I'll come back to it in exactly at the end of this seminar and have nothing to say about it. All right, now, as I said, this Penrose diagram is also the Penrose diagram for De Sitter space. And the symmetries of this Penrose diagram are also the symmetries of De Sitter space. The symmetries of it, I'm talking about the symmetries of the Penrose diagram alone, they simply have time-like killing vectors in these corners over here. The time-like killing vectors point upward over here, point downward over here. You know the picture. Point space-like in this wedge and space-like in that wedge. The group is, of course, the group of Lorentz transformations in 1 plus 1 dimensions for the simple Penrose diagram piece of the symmetry group. And that symmetry group and this whole structure is exactly the same as the structure of De Sitter space. The metrical structure, as I said, is quite different. What was the boundary of De Sitter space, of anti-De Sitter space, excuse me, now becomes the observer, let's call it the observer, sitting at one pole. This here is a sphere. In 1 plus 1 dimensional De Sitter space, it's just a circle. In 2 plus 1 dimensional De Sitter space, it's a sphere, and so forth and so on. And if we imagine an observer sitting at a fixed location, there's the observer sitting at a fixed location, coming in from infinity, going out at infinity, we can call that point r equals 0. I refuse to call this scry plus and this scry minus. I will not do that. That's disgusting distortion of the original terminology. I'm going to call this the infinitely inflated future and the infinitely inflated past. Isn't scry supposed to be light-like?
No.
Well, then I hate it. It's even worse. Even worse.
It's script I.
Yeah, I know what it means.
Okay.
I know.
And it's just a conformal boundary, whether it's time-like, space-like, or not.
Was I hate that. However, I will pay tribute to Strominger in one way, although I will not call this the Southern Diamond. I will instead call it the causal patch. I will yield to those people and draw it on the right side of the diagram instead of the left side of the diagram. Okay, so here is the Sitter space in global coordinates. This time, which appears here, it's a different time than appears here in general, but I'll tell you what the connection is in a moment. The time slices through here are the time slices of the global De Sitter space, and as we know, it's a Robertson-Walker type space with a scale factor which grows exponentially in the past and the future. R is simply the scale factor, which is closely related to the Hubble parameter, which is closely related to the cosmological constant. And I'll parameterize everything by R, by the radius of curvature. The Hubble parameter is inverse to the radius of curvature. the geometry, or a patch of the geometry. In this case, the static patch that I drew over here, which is analogous to the exterior of the ADS black hole. It's analogous to the exterior of the ADS. Notice they both have two lines. In the ADS case, these were the two boundaries. In the DS case, these are the observers at antipodal points of the sphere. This is one point on the sphere, and the other observer is at the other point in the sphere. They can never communicate with each other. And here is the static patch. The static patch is described by this metric over here. Again, r squared on the outside, 1 minus r squared dt squared, the r squared over this thing here, minus r squared times a, what would be a two-sphere in four dimensions. Now, this looks very much like a black hole metric, and in fact, it does have a horizon. The horizon is the place where the coefficient of dt goes to zero and the coefficient of dr goes to infinity. And it looks very, very much like a Schwarzschild-type horizon. You know, of course, it's a little bit different, but it looks very much like a Schwarzschild horizon. Locally, it's a Rindler horizon, so locally it looks very much like a Schwarzschild horizon. And it occurs, of course, at r equals 1. Now, I just want to point out one thing. In both of these metrics, apart from this factor of r over here, which appears in both of them, dt over here measures proper time along the observer's trajectory. It is also true that t over here measures proper time along the observer's trajectory. So at r equals 0, these two times are the same times. I wanted to point that out because people have gotten themselves very confused thinking that they are different. They are different at r not equal to 0, but at r equals 0, these two times, in other words, the static patch time and the global time here are the same. So in particular, if I'm interested in correlators at different times along the world line of the observer, there are also correlators at the origin of the static patch in the same time units. All right, the horizon is at r equals 1. And I'm going to argue, without any further argument, that the same concept of complementarity should make sense here. The horizon has exactly the same features as the horizon in the ADS case, similar to the horizons in ordinary Schwarzschild black holes. And I am going to assume, without further argument, that information contained within this static patch is conserved and never lost behind the horizon. That's an assumption I will make. In other words, that the ideas of black hole complementarity still make sense in the context of De Sitter space.
It's implying that there are as many reasons to believe in them making sense in this case as there are?
No, I don't think there are. But I think the reason for that is because I think there's less reason to believe that quantum mechanics makes any sense. Yeah. Yeah, so it's not clear what a measurement means. It's not clear what so yes, I am making a big fat assumption here that the concepts of quantum mechanics and make sense, and that we can apply the same. Now, if the concepts of quantum mechanics don't make sense, even better. even better. Then. Somebody sits there at the center, or attempts to sit there at the center, and makes measurements. Now, yeah. Now, what does it mean that information is conserved? And I'm going to say one signal of information being conserved. Well, let's not come to that yet. Let's not say what the signal is yet.
Actually, I disagree that only the breakdown of quantum mechanics altogether would be a reason not to believe this. I mean, another reason not to believe this is that you cannot actually measure the entire information, in the sense that the entropy of a cosmological horizon is larger than the entropy of any black hole inside of it.
That's true. So it's hard to imagine an apparatus that would be enough, big enough to collect the right. Right.
Measure the whole thing to see.
I agree with that. And I'm quite uncertain on my ground on this. Okay. The experience thus far has been that horizons like this, well, one argument would be classical physics in a patch like this should have a self-contained description within this patch. Right? Completely self-contained description within this patch in the sense that this line here is t equals minus infinity, this line here is t equals plus infinity, and so anything which comes in from here is thought of as part of the initial conditions. Anything which goes out here is thought of as part of the final conditions, and obviously nothing can squeeze out through that point there. So classically, field theory could be done in this patch here with nothing unusual. Just you have to put down initial conditions, you have to put down final conditions. Yeah, but that is from the static point, that is just the point t equals minus infinity. That is t equals minus infinity. And we expect then the static patch to have to put input in the form of initial data and final data. As an example of initial data and final data, there's some convention about... No, it's not a space-like surface, it's a light-like surface. Right. But it does correspond to t equals minus infinity and t equals plus infinity. Only if it's finite, right. Yeah, here it is. Here's fixed t, t equals 0, t equals 1, t equals 2, t equals 3, t equals 4, t equals blah, 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 t equals infinity. Okay, now it's become conventional to define the objects which could come into and out of horizons to be called elephants. And so... here's a kind of situation that you might ask, what does it mean from the point of view of the static patch? I will come back to what it means later. But for the moment, just think about the experiment where we throw in an elephant from the remote past. The elephant passes into the static patch and out of the static patch. And one description of this is just to say the elephant was there at t equals minus infinity, and it was there at t equals plus infinity. But the entire evolution of the elephant for finite times is governed by more or less sensible Hamiltonian quantum mechanics. I just drew that because I like drawing elephants. I do, I really do, especially pink ones. Okay, so now let me address the question. Supposing we're string theorists or something like string theorists, and we want to do our business in De Sitter space. Or for that matter, I would also say in the ADS black hole. Well, one view, and I think it's in some sense the view that I think most people shared, I certainly thought about it some, is that you should go to the boundary again, and that you should define vertex operators at the boundary of the De Sitter space, and think about correlation functions between vertices in the remote past and the remote future. In other words, objects which would describe some sort of scattering amplitudes in De Sitter space where you impose initial conditions on the remote past and final conditions on the remote future in the form, for example, of particle input in the remote past, particle output in the remote future. Perhaps there are constraints on how many particles you can put in without collapsing the space and so forth. But one view, which I think was a prevalent view, is that this is a set of objects which should make sense, and these are the things that string theory might be able to define. Quantum field theoretic analogs of it in the bulk, and now I mean quantum field theory in the bulk, low energy approximations to it might just be ordinary quantum field theory in the fixed background of the anti-De Sitter space. This might include gravitons, it might include photons and everything else, interactions, do Feynman diagrams in it, and calculate some correlators on the boundary. Okay. The existence of these correlators has been unquestioned up till now, as far as I know. And these correlators form the basis for this, the Sitter-CFT possible connection that's been advocated by Strominger and some of his friends. Not my friends, his friends.
Anyway?
They used to be my friends. Right. Once again, the symmetry group of the Sitter space acting on the boundary of the Sitter space, and the boundary now means the infinitely inflated future and the infinitely inflated past, that group is again a version of the conformal group. And so the expectation might be that there exists on these boundaries, and I'm not going to get into the issue of whether you should think of one boundary or two boundaries. Well, I think one boundary is probably more sensible than two boundaries, and so I think.
Space-like.
Yeah, space-like boundary. Space-like boundary now. That there's a holographic description in terms of a space-like boundary where some sort of boundary quantum field theory, excuse me, now it's a boundary classical statistical mechanics, I guess, since it's purely Euclidean, a boundary field theory on a Euclidean surface like this, through various kinds of infrared and IR-UV connections would define things in the bulk through the same kind of connections that appear in anti-de Sitter space. Okay, so that's the hypothesis, that there does exist a set of such correlators, and that these correlators can be thought of as the correlators in a field theory on a space-like boundary, analogous to the previous case of ADS. So I'm going to go through a very simple argument to argue that this is probably not the case, that this doesn't look good to me. All right, the example I'll follow is the same example that was followed by Strominger and his friends. And it's the example of a scalar field of mass m moving in the Sitter space. The wave equation can be solved, and it takes about 2 minutes. This is as much as I can do. I could not solve the wave equation in the Sitter space, but what I can easily do is figure out what the behavior of the field is near the infinitely inflated past and the infinitely inflated future, and the answer is e to the minus gamma t. In other words, as you move closer and closer to the boundary, exponential falloff again. This is the same sort of exponential falloff that was found by solving the wave equation in the anti-de Sitter space black hole. For the general case, in d spatial dimensions, this gamma here is generally complex, in particular if the mass is bigger than the Hubble parameter times something or other, then this coefficient here is complex, but it always has a positive real part, so that phi exponentially falls as you go toward either of the boundaries. Same sort of exponential behavior as found before. The existence of this type of behavior, these are the objects that you strip off the correlators to define things with well-defined boundary values, and which would form the basis for this DSCFT conjecture. My question is whether these limits actually exist in this case. I know they exist in the previous case, whether these limits exist and whether they make any, well, just whether they exist, and I'm going to argue that they don't exist. Right. Now, to do that, I want to go back to the static patch. And the static patch, again, remember that in the static patch, you can think of it as a geometry. I haven't written the metric here, but if you remember, the geometry went from r equals 0 to r equals 1. In the static patch, the metric is static, right? So it's time independent. It extends from r equals 0, which was where the observer was sitting, way over on the right side of the diagram, to r equals 1, which is at the horizon, that's over here. And so in this case here, you're surrounded by a horizon. It's a horizon very much like a black hole horizon, but you're surrounded by it. And at the center is the observer who's looking out around him or herself and sees a horizon on every side. Now, unlike the anti-de Sitter case, the horizon is quite different than the boundary of anti-de Sitter space. In particular, the boundary is hot. The boundary is hot because it's a horizon. If you work out the temperature that a static observer would see, now I mean a static observer at a fixed value of R, first of all, if you're at R equals zero, then it's easy to compute that the temperature is just 1 over 2 pi R. The bigger the de Sitter space, the bigger the radius, the lower the temperature. That's certainly what we expect. And if you move out along space-like directions, you'll find the temperature grows, and it nominally grows to infinity at the horizon at R equals 1. This is the same phenomena that happens for a Schwarzschild black hole, that the Unruh temperature, the proper Unruh temperature as you go toward the horizon diverges. It's also expected, and there are experts here who can tell you why. I've never completely understood the thermodynamic argument, but I believe it, that this geometry has an entropy. For me, it just has an entropy because thus far, every time I've ever seen a horizon, if the horizon had an area, it had an entropy. There are smarter arguments, serious arguments based on the on transferring entropy back and forth to black holes in the de Sitter space. And I don't think I need to get into that. I think probably most of us would be convinced that if it has an area and it's a horizon, then it should have an entropy, and the entropy should be the area divided by 4 in Planck units. So I will make that assumption. And that's that. Now, the complementarity principle that I'm going to use and that I'm going to assume is that the physics in this cavity is the physics of... Good question. No, it's the entropy as seen for the universe from inside, as measured to the extent that it can be measured. Now, I share your feelings about this, that this may not make good operational sense. And
the problem is before, right? I mean, you can say it's the information content of the horizon, but it's a very different angle. The horizon doesn't evaporate.
Yeah. From the Penrose diagram point of view, this line here plays the same role as the boundary of the anti-de Sitter space. Now, there's a big difference. There is a big difference that since the entropy is bounded in here, this observer here can, sitting in this thermal bath, can't have arbitrary complexity and do arbitrary experiments. And I worry about that. This is part of the reason I worry about whether quantum mechanics makes any sense. But my assumption is going to be that whatever takes place in here can be modeled by a closed, finite cavity, and closed means that information cannot disappear out of it, satisfying the standard rules of quantum mechanics within the cavity. The cavity has the property that it gets very hot near the boundary. That doesn't mean it's not in thermal equilibrium. It means that it has a non-trivial metric, a non-trivial G naught naught. And so I'm going to say that complementarity in this case means that this cavity can be modeled by a closed system, a system that no information can get out of or into, in the same way as a black hole horizon has that property. And see where that leads me. It's going to lead me to some place where I think the advocates of DSCFT don't want to be driven, but on the other hand, that is where it's going to drive them. Okay, so complementarity says that the de Sitter space inside a single causally connected region behaves like a closed, sealed, finite cavity with hot walls. The hot walls are horizons, and that the horizons can store, thermalize, and re-emit all information. This last sentence, the last half of this sentence, comes out of my paper on black hole complementarity from about 10 years ago, except as applied to black holes rather than to de Sitter space. So now let's look at correlators. Let's look again at the correlators, phi of...
Even at this point, there's a big difference, right? Because the horizon is this physical object in this picture.
Yeah.
But here it's an observer dependent.
It is. It is. It is.
How can you
have an Let's come back to it. The question is, how do you fit together all the observers? Right, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit, or I'm going to try to talk about it a little bit. How do you fit them all together into one comprehensive picture? I think the answer is that the DS symmetry group has to be thought of as gauged, and that they're all equivalent to each other, and that they all see exactly the same thing.
Is it clear that you need to put them
together? No, I don't think it's clear that you need to put them together. If you're inside one of them, if you're one of them, you don't need to put them together. Right. But there is a question of whether you can put them together in some bigger structure.
I think you have to, because you know there are more observers than just the ones at the antipodal side of the sphere. You can have one at zero, one at theta equals epsilon. So they can be very close.
They
all have different cavities, but they will be able to talk to each other for a very long time.
Yeah.
And they'll see the same events.
Yeah.
And so they have to be able to agree on the description, or at least agree on any physical measurement.
Right.
You have to have a description that works for any one of them.
They have to be. I believe they have to be fit together into some kind of structure, and presumably that structure is some representation of the symmetry group of the space. But for the moment, I don't want to get into that. I just want to say, what do we know if we know that one single observer can be described as a thermal cavity? What do we know, and what can we conclude from that? All right. So in particular, what I want to ask about is correlators between fields, bulk fields. These don't have to be local bulk fields. These could be any kind of objects which are quantum mechanical degrees of freedom that can be said to reside at particular times. My assumption is that this geometry, that this system can be modeled as a conventional Hamiltonian system with properties that satisfy the standard rules of quantum mechanics. So in particular, if there are some operators, Heisenberg operators, at different times, I can ask what the correlation function between them is. And the answer that you get by calculating wave equations in the de Sitter space, this we could go right back to the original de Sitter space, global coordinates if we like, and calculate the correlators at two different times, as I mentioned before, is of the form e to the minus gamma. And when either of the times approaches the asymptotic boundary, these things exponentially go to zero. Combine that with time translation invariance in the static coordinates, and the correlators at two points at the origin, let's say, two points located at the origin, will go like e to the minus gamma t1 minus t2. Now, is this surprising? This is not surprising at all that it goes like e to the minus gamma t. Remember, gamma was a complex number. As I said, this is just a phenomena of dissipation. The various possible values of gamma, the real part of gamma, think about it as damped harmonic oscillators. You can have a damped harmonic oscillator which is overdamped, underdamped, or just marginally damped. If you look at the formula that I gave you for gamma, it had a square root, an I times a square root. If the mass was bigger than the Hubble parameter, then there was a complex part. That means it's underdamped and oscillates a few times before it damps out. If the mass is very low, then it's underdamped and just exponentially goes to zero. And there's some marginal case, which is just marginally damped. So all this is, from the point of view of the static patch, is dissipation in a thermal bath. In other words, you perturb the system and you look for the results of the perturbation at a later time, and they will exponentially die off due to friction in the thermal bath. Now, the only problem, so thus far, everything is consistent. The e to the minus gamma t is there for thermal reasons. It's exactly what you need to strip off in order to have the CFT connection. However, it's inconsistent with the assumptions that the thermal cavity has finite entropy. So let me show you why that is. And now I am giving the argument that was not given in Maldacena's paper. It leads to a somewhat different little picture than what Maldacena had, I think. But I don't think he was wrong. I think he just wasn't complete. I'll tell you what really happens. So let's look at correlators in finite entropy cavities. Finite entropy cavities are different than infinite space. Dissipation happens in infinite space. Something a little bit different happens in finite systems. And finite systems, I now mean systems with finite entropy. I don't necessarily even mean that they have finitely many degrees of freedom. They could have infinitely many degrees of freedom, like a field theory in a box. But a field theory in a box heated to finite temperature has finite entropy. Okay. Now, one thing about systems of finite entropy, if they have finite entropy, it means they have discrete spectrum, because the entropy is essentially just the logarithm of the number of discrete states per unit energy interval. No system that has a continuum of energy levels has finite entropy. So, and that's all I'm going to use. All I'm going to use is that finite entropy means discrete spectrum. So let's consider a non-equal time correlator between two quantities in a thermal state. We know how to write that. This is the correlation function. It has 1 over the partition function. It has a trace of e to the minus beta h. And it has the operator a, and then the operator a shifted. And if we sum over a complete and discrete set of eigenvectors of the energy, this is what we would get. This is a function of time. It's a Fourier transform of a function of time. And it's a discrete Fourier, a sum over a discrete set of frequencies. Well, no such sum can ever have the property that it asymptotically exponentially goes to zero. And in fact, you can calculate the long time average of the correlator. By that I mean you take the correlator, I'll define it in terms of the square of the correlator. Square the correlator f star f, this is complex in general. Take f star f, integrate it from time minus infinity, from time minus t to t, and divide by 1 over 2t, and let t go to infinity. So this is the long time average of the square of the correlator. If the correlator goes to zero asymptotically, in particular if it goes to zero exponentially, then the long time average has to vanish. This is just saying that most of the time it's zero. Only for a finite amount of time is it not zero, and so the long time average vanishes. Okay, so the naive calculation based on wave equations in the de Sitter space give L equals zero. But it's easy enough to calculate explicitly just by squaring this integrating over time and doing the appropriate limit. It's very easy to calculate what you actually get, and I'll write down, I'll tell you what you get. You get the following strictly positive sum. L is a sum over 4 energy levels. It's not terribly important what it is. The temperature enters in here, 2 energy levels here. The matrix elements of A appear quartically, and then there's a Kronecker delta, not a delta function, but a Kronecker delta of the discrete energy levels, which is equal to zero if this quantity here is anything but zero, and it's equal to one otherwise. There are certainly terms in this sum which are non-zero. For example, take Ej, let's take Ek equal Ei and Ej equal El, all right? And there are definitely terms, and so this is a positive definite quantity. And its positiveness is due to the fact that it's non-zero, is due to the fact that the spectrum is discrete. It's strictly due to the fact that the spectrum is discrete. Now, so, let's forget for the moment what its magnitude is. It's a little hard to read off here from what the magnitude is, because you have to know what the matrix elements of A are like. And you can ask what the matrix elements of A get like as the spectrum gets denser and denser. I'm interested in how this thing behaves as a function of the entropy, which means as a function of the level spacing. The inverse level, the level spacing defines the entropy. These A's would tend to get smaller and smaller with increasing level density, but that's not important for us now. So the long time average is certainly not equal to zero as maintained by Maldacena. Okay, what does the correlation function actually do? The answer is not that it goes exponentially start going exponentially to zero, but then just levels off and stays flat. That is not what it does. What it does is it starts to get noisy, and it fluctuates. It fluctuates with fluctuations, and in fact, if you wait long enough, it will fluctuate with an arbitrarily big fluctuation. Well, not quite arbitrarily big. It'll fluctuate up to about the same size that the correlation function had at time t equals zero. The times you have to wait are basically Poincaré recurrence times, and they're extremely long, Googleplexes of years in the real universe. But for a small universe, a universe of a few Planck lengths, this would be a phenomenon which would be quite noisy. Okay. I've labeled these points elephants. I'll come back to why they're elephants in a moment. Incidentally, the time interval between sizable fluctuations, between elephants, so to speak, the time interval between big fluctuations is typically of order e to the entropy. That's the Poincaré recurrence time. So the correlation function...
How about Heisenberg?
Is that right? Thank you. That's the point. Let me tell you, when you're dealing with things of size 10 to the 10 to the 120, it doesn't matter what units. All right. My colleagues and I, Lisa Dyson, who is not related to Freeman Dyson, and James Lindesay, we did some numerical studies of these things. Now, I'll tell you what the numerical studies are. They're not numerical studies of the Sitter space. They're just take a random Hamiltonian, take a random matrix Hamiltonian, take a couple of random operators, calculate their correlation function with the random matrix Hamiltonian, and compute the correlators. And here's about what they look like. Everything's been squeezed down, so the entire period of exponential dissipation is all in this very tiny region here, and then they do what they do. As you increase the entropy, the magnitude of the correlator gets smaller. Incidentally, if you look at the scales here, you will see that as you increase the entropy, the time scales between fluctuations get longer, big fluctuations get longer and longer. So increasing the entropy, n is some measure, logarithm of n is a measure of the entropy here. The entire signal does get smaller and smaller, but no matter how small the entire signal is, if you wait long enough, you will find a big spike. So this spike was from some relatively large n. And then what happens when it spikes is it simply follows the dissipative curve again until it gets noisy again. So that is the general thing which happens to systems of finite entropy after very, very long times. Now, we come back then to what an elephant means, entering and leaving the geometry. Well, what an elephant means is simply a random thermal fluctuation that originates in this picture. Oh, incidentally, you cannot throw in elephants from the boundaries. Why not? The reason you can't throw in elephants from the boundaries is because of dissipation. An elephant, which is present at time t equals zero, will surely be gone. It will be thermalized. It will be degraded by the thermal radiation in the cavity and eventually come to thermal equilibrium with the rest of the cavity. In other words, just be evaporated after a sufficiently long time. That means you can't throw an elephant in a sufficiently at an arbitrarily early time, because if you threw it in,
your horizon was T horizon.
I'm not saying you can't have an elephant pass through here. You can. What I'm saying is it doesn't make any sense to start an elephant here.
You can have an elephant follow a GD sequence, which is not the world line of the origin of your static patch.
So now let's follow the elephant in its own frame of reference, okay? In its own frame of reference, it's subjected continuously to thermal radiation. No matter how weak that thermal radiation is, that elephant is eventually going to be thermalized.
But he'll last longer than the observer.
What observer? The elephant is the observer.
But the one that's in the cat.
It may last a very long time. It may last exponentially long.
The proper time for the elephant to get into the patch is infinite.
Right. The proper time for the elephant to get into the back. So even in its own frame, an elephant is just a thermal fluctuation. But in this other frame, where it comes in and it goes out, you can think of it as a thermal fluctuation which originates at the huge number of degrees of freedom, thermal degrees of freedom near the boundary. There's a huge reservoir of degrees of freedom. And every so often, an elephant will occur. That's what an elephant coming in is. An elephant going out is much easier to think about. It's just being absorbed into the hot thermal radiation. So that, I think, is the right picture, if there is one, of the quantum mechanics of the sitter space. Now, an interesting question is, why does quantum field theory give that the long time average goes to zero rather than doing this thermal fluctuation? Quantum field theory, I now mean naive quantum field theory. It doesn't have to be free field theory. It could be interacting field theory in a fixed background. That will always give, I maintain it will always give L, the long time average, will always go to zero, as if the entropy of the cavity was equal to infinity. So the question is, why is that so? And the answer is very simple. The answer is that in the quantum field theoretic approximation to a horizon, the entropy of the horizon is divergent. To see that, it's very easy to see it for a simple four-dimensional horizon. The temperature, the Unruh temperature, goes like 1/1 the distance from the horizon. If we just calculate the entropy density in thermal gas, it goes like T to the power D. So that means it goes like 1/(ρ) to the power D. And so the total entropy is the area times the divergent integral. It's always a divergent integral. And so the entropy diverges because of infinitely many low frequency modes arbitrarily close to the horizon. Given that in this approximation, the quantum field theory approximation, the entropy is divergent, that's the reason why in the naive approximation, L goes to zero. The lesson to learn from this, I think, is that quantum field theory always gives the wrong answer to any problem which is specifically sensitive to the finiteness of the entropy of the horizon. I think it always gives the wrong answer. If the issue in question is one which depends on the finiteness of the entropy of the horizon, I will call these Maldacena fluctuations. The Maldacena fluctuations do depend on the finiteness of the entropy, and I believe they ruin the possibility of correlators having the appropriate behavior for the so-called DS-CFT. I had one more remark. I seem to have lost it. The other remark has already been made by David, so I'll make it on the blackboard. And one more remark was made by David, but it was following the remark of Maldacena. The long time average, now as I said, the long time average is just a long time average. This is noise, and it can jump up and be arbitrarily big, but various integrals that you could do over it will typically be exponentially small. And the exponential smallness will typically be some power constant times the entropy. Well, we know what the entropy is. The entropy is R squared divided by R to the d minus 2, but in four dimensions, R squared divided by G Newton, or in string theory, e to the minus c R squared over G squared alpha prime. So the structure of these effects appears to be non-perturbative effects in the Newton constant. What are these effects? Well, Maldacena has speculated in a way that has not convinced me, but it also hasn't, I'm also not particularly against the idea, that somehow sums over topologies are what give rise to this. This I have my doubts about. I don't know if it's right or not, but it is some sort of non-perturbative effect that can never be seen in perturbation theory. No matter how many Feynman diagrams you draw, no matter how many string diagrams you draw, you will not see this effect. So the effect is very, very small. It's negligible, but it does undo the existence of the objects which the CFT-DS is supposed to be about. Now, does that mean that the CFT-DS or DS-CFT is useless? I don't think so.
Well, I think it just adds another contribution.
Well, it adds another contribution, but it's a contribution which destroys, which doesn't have the right limiting behavior.
No, but if you take the Montesina example,
yes,
you have the determinative contribution, which is full of exponential.
Yes.
And then you'd have an instant or another topology.
Yep.
It would give a very small constant peak.
But what I'm telling you, right. What I'm telling you is that these are not small constant pieces. They are noise which no matter how small the noise is, if you wait long enough, they will make arbitrarily big excursions. So how to find a way to get rid of these fluctuations, I don't know.
No, but if you let's assume that something like Von Zeppelin is right. If you had sort of string theory, you had a sum over different.
Yeah.
And what? And the simplest analogy would be that the bond would compute the ordinary quantum field.
Right.
That would be a piece.
Yeah. No. My point is that this is different than the ADS-CFT, which, whether you sum over topologies or not, these limits are expected to exactly exist. They will not be noisy.
You're saying ADS can't get it from the boundary, and DS you really can't.
Right. Right.
That's right.
It's a real difference. Now, does that mean that the DS-CFT is useless? I don't think so. I think it's probably very, very interesting. But this is a limitation of it. And it's kind of an odd limitation. Let me just point out what this would mean. Let's suppose there is a CFT which has the right properties to reproduce this stuff. Well, this is going to be a very odd kind of theory. I think it's still true. This is now the space-like holographic boundary. You move upward in time from the space-like boundary, and moving upward in time does correspond, does it not, to dilatation. So a degree of freedom at one time over here would correspond to some blob of that size. Let's call it a Wilson loop. Let's give it a name, but it may not be a Wilson loop. Let's just call it a Wilson loop of a certain size. Another one down here would be a Wilson loop of a smaller size. Now, usually what happens is if we were to hold one fixed and let the other one shrink, we would generate some local operator. And we could talk about the correlator of these two loops. It's what I called AA. And we would expect that this has a smooth and continuous limit. As one of them shrinks to zero, the smooth and continuous limit would just be the correlator of the blob with the local field. This is some very funny kind of theory it has to be, where this limit, if you shrink them both down simultaneously, that's time translation invariance, that's a perfectly good symmetry. If you shrink one of them relative to the other, it has to undergo this noisy kind of behavior. What kind of theory? I've never seen a theory that could do that. But
that's just
the dilatation. That's fine. That's fine. It's the shrinking of one of them relative to the other, which normally would define a matrix element between some, let's call it a non-local operator and local field. Normally we expect that to exist. Okay? In this case, I think in approximations it can exist, but I think at the end of the day it can't exactly exist. So this is, that's what I came to say. I hope people will think about this problem, not this particular problem, but this problem of what's behind the horizon, because we seem to have no good ideas about it. Good.
So what are the DS people have to say?
I'm sure they'll find something. I'm not so sure it's well taken at Harvard.
There's another point one can add on your elephants that they can't come from infinity. The cavity picture really is incompatible with a global picture, also in the sense that in the cavity picture you would expect elephants, because of the recurrences, elephants to come back infinitely many times.
Yes.
If you thought of each one of these elephants as having come from Scry Minus, sorry. There will be a lot of elephants, and in fact, there will be more elephants on Scry Minus than are compatible with the geometry of the space-time. So there really is a contradiction in
all of this is exploring the trouble you get into if you try to think of this theory with a finite number of degrees of freedom.
Well, if you really want the answers, I think that.
I never said I had a finite number of degrees of freedom. I said I have a finite entropy.
Yeah. I agree that we need a description of the cavity. And to me, the question is whether it's useful to try to exploit the asymptotic symmetries and whether they have something indirect to say. I don't think that there's physical meaning in describing what's going on near Scry.
But in your examples, you have a finite
number. Numerical
examples.
Nice. Yeah. The numerical examples of finite matrices. I do believe in some of those examples, the entropy was a lot less than log of n, though. So.
I think I agree with what you're saying, but there's something which is a little bit puzzling. If you look at the Schwarzschild ADF case, and you say, okay, the correlators fall off exponentially if you just do the quantum field theory in curved space-time. I mean, that can be understood as you sort of perturb the black hole and the field falls into the horizon.
That it's just from the field theory point of view, that it's thermal
perturbed dissipation. Perturbed thermal state, right. But let's think about it from the gravity side.
Yeah.
So from the gravity side, it's just that your perturbation is falling into the black hole.
Absolutely.
Okay. So this is sort of these quasi-normal modes that people have studied.
That's right.
Okay. But that's true for any cavity. I mean, it doesn't have to be a horizon. So you could actually take a time-like whirl tube out of ADS and put in some field. And if you have like one-way membrane, suppose you let the radiation come in, but it can't get out again, so the cavity just captures the radiation. I mean, so that would also have a field which outside it which would decay exponentially, and you could define quasi-normal modes for that sort of situation as well. And it would decay just the same way.
But it's a little different than a horizon.
It's different. Okay, so what I'm saying is that the interpretation, it looks the same from the gravity side, but on one you say, we really have a finite number of degrees of freedom, so we have to modify the picture.
Let me see.
In the other case, you say, well, okay, we have an infinite number of degrees of freedom.
Okay, you're saying, supposing I had a cavity and you want to put in here a one-way membrane?
Yeah, so let's just let the waves sort of, you know, put on boundary conditions which are, you know,
in your one-way membrane does not itself have an infinite entropy?
Well, it has a finite area, but it's not a horizon.
No. This is not a gravitational system. Yeah. This is a
fixed background
reflecting walls and some kind of a membrane in it.
Yeah, a one-way membrane which lets the field in.
Oh, really? It's a finite temperature, do you mind?
I would rather keep it at zero temperature.
I'd keep it at zero temperature.
Yeah.
Okay. So zero is a special case of finite temperature. The answer is what I said, that the correlation functions cannot go to zero for the argument that I gave. They cannot, which proves that there can't be a one-way membrane.
Wait a minute, but you're assuming that the entropy is finite when you made your argument.
Could have been zero. Could have been zero. Zero is even better.
No, but
zero is even better.
The entropy
it can't be infinite. typically what happens to zero entropy systems is things oscillate and
this is some tiny little thing in a big ADS. I mean, why is it just the entropy of the tiny boundary at the origin that's relevant? Why isn't all the sort of degrees of freedom in ADS?
If there's enough states there, things can fall in and just get lost among this enormous number of states. So in a quantum field theory approximation where there's this huge number of states near the boundary or near the horizon, one description of it, the description from within the cavity, this is the wrong thing that's going on here, but it doesn't matter, is that the system is getting lost among this huge number of degrees of freedom that's accounting for the divergence of entropy.
In this other case where your boundary is time-like, you don't have a horizon and you don't have the infinite number of low-energy states right outside it. You solve the wave equation and it just looks...
There's an infinite number of high-energy states, but
then... Always have an infinite number of high-energy states.
Yeah, okay. So what's the point now?
Well, the point is that from the gravity side, the calculation for this exponential decay of your correlators would look the same as for a horizon.
Wait, you're talking a pure vacuum ADS?
Well, with a hole cut out of the middle.
What does a hole cut out of the middle mean? Is this hole that's cut out in the middle, is it a physical part of the system? Is it connected by a hose to some infinite heat bath, maybe? If it is, then this is an infinite entropy system, and it is correct that that the correlation functions will go to zero and dissipate. So if it's connected by a hose to something with infinite entropy, yes. But if it's any kind of physical system, which itself has at most finite entropy, then the correlation functions have to do what I said. There's no way around that. That was just the Fourier transforms of discrete systems, of discrete functions. So I think it proves you can't have a one-way membrane.
You can have some infinite sink, some sink.
Unless it's connected to something which can dissipate away the information and lose it among an infinite number of degrees of freedom, the correlator will jump around and be noisy. So, it's fun system. We should figure out the universe. It's cool.
Any more questions? Let's thank Lenny again.
Great talk, despite all the abuse.
I didn't hear what he said, though. Maybe I shouldn't.
It was a great talk, despite all the abuse.
Yeah, but you know that I only abuse people.
Thank you.
I started to. I always read everything this guy writes. He writes good stuff. He's very, very good. I started to, and I got a little ways through it.
There's one problem I had with this. I don't know Gilad very well, but I think Dan is first class.
There's one thing which maybe will go away once I reach the end of time, but the maximal entropy here will just keep growing. And they said, well, that's because, you know, things are right here in the maximal area.
Yeah.
But of course, in considering, you can make the argument that this just vastly overestimates the entropy. You should really look at this light sheet, which has the area R squared again, and which covers the entire entropy on the slice. So it's not true that the entropy can ever actually exceed this even globally. What I didn't understand yet is to what extent our arguments depend on what I think is a wrong assumption about that.
We may talk about this dual conformal field theory one day very much.
I don't know.
Unknown object.
They have this.
No, it's the one that's dual here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do
they? No, it's
the same framework.
I think they have the scaling going on where one lattice site on their conformal field theory corresponds to this portion.
But that's just the definition of what you mean by lattice space. So saying that it's ABS in some sense, one of them are n squared degrees of freedom for,
yeah,
for horizons.
Which is why it rings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Mark.
Good.
Cookies.
Oh,
cookies.